This episode of Working Lunch is fueled by P.F. Chang's, but not just P.F. Chang's, Franklin, P.F. Chang's To Go. The company is experimenting with to-go outlets, not the normal eat-in dining room. What do you think about that?
Love it. We have a P.F. Chang's near our house, and during the pandemic, when we needed a change-up, we'd get it to go. It's fairly expensive for, takeout, but it's delicious. And the only other option for us is Payway, which is like, they got to get their act together in the takeout. It's always crazy in there and a little different deal. So I'm happy. I'm very, very happy, Joe.
Yeah, and I'm a big P.F. Chang's fan. I love P.F. Chang's. There's a ton of entrees I have there in my go-to. But, I like the interiors of P.F. Chang's. I think they're well-designed. They've got a good bar scene in the middle kind of thing. I like the kind of rounded shape of some of those dining rooms. So P.F. Chang's is one of those good atmosphere-type places. So I hope no knock against food quality. Great, I love it. I just hope it can stand alone without that very active bar and the dining room and the kind of the energy of that dining room. But we have one of them. There's one in the state of Florida, Franklin, and not too far from us. So you and I need to get run down and get some P.F. Chang's to go and check out this new unit. And on that happy note, let's do the show.
May I help you?
We need to talk about your flair.
I think I'm going to have to go super side.
I'm proud to be a bartender. Ain't nothing wrong with that.
We need a political revolution.
Mr. Vice President speaking.
Come on, man.
With all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey.
From the home office of Align Public Strategies in downtown Orlando, Florida, this is Working Lunch. Coming up on the podcast, labor shortages, supply chain issues, and ever-increasing food prices are putting unprecedented pressure on a business model that already runs on thin margins. But what impact is all this having on the attractiveness of the industry for investment, either stock prices, the private equity space, or purchasing franchises? We're joined by a regular contributor to the pod, our friend Michael Halen, the senior restaurant industry analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, to help us understand the impacts that these outside pressures are having on the financial health of the industry. And at a time when newsrooms across the country are eliminating staff, one area of major investment is the labor workforce and workplace beat. We'll discuss why major publications are escalating their reporting in this space and how it can impact the employer community. We'll discuss those issues and wrap it up with the legislative scorecard. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the show. I'm Joe Kefauver, along with my Align Public Strategies partner. And Franklin, we've talked a lot in the last few weeks about all these mounting pressures on the business model, on margins, what's going on in the labor market, what's going on in supply chain, rising food prices. Man, it is, for restaurateurs who are used to, fighting the beast every day, this has been an unprecedented time. And, you and I were talking about the industry writ large and its appeal, its attractiveness for investment. Are people in pension funds and little stock buying groups still buying publicly traded restaurant company stock? Are private equity firms still looking to move into this sector? Are there maybe more attractive places that are less susceptible to what's going on in the external environment? Are franchisors struggling to sell franchises in this environment? So we thought we'd bring our old friend Michael Halen from Bloomberg Intelligence, the senior restaurant industry analyst, and have that conversation with him and let him tell us what's what and who's who. And let's get to that interview. Well, as our listeners know, we have spent a lot of time over the last few weeks talking about the pressure on bottom lines, the pressure on margin from a variety of factors, what's going on in the labor market with wage inflation, what's going on in the supply chain, what's going on in general inflation across the board. And it's an unprecedented set of restaurant pressures on operators right now that we have just not seen in a long, long time. And to kind of help us sort it out, I've asked my good friend Michael Halen, senior restaurant analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Michael has been on the pod many, many times, helped us sort out the numbers of the industry and kind of be somewhat predictive about where we're heading. Michael has joined us again. Mike, thanks for being on Working Lunch again, and Happy New Year, pal.
Thanks for having me. Happy New Year to you as well.
All right, man. Well, so a lot going on out there. And, if I'm a CEO of a major restaurant company, I am probably sweating more profusely than I have been. Talk to me a little bit about what the mood is out there among the companies that you cover, and what's it like out there with the pressure on these wages? and the pressure on supply and food prices. What's the environment like?
Yeah, I think I used this phrase last time we spoke, but it's kind of out of the frying pan and into the fire, right? And as soon as sales came back, they got hit with a pretty significant amount of labor and food inflation. So I guess we'll tackle the staffing issues first, right? So clearly restaurants have been very difficult to staff. About 30%, I've seen estimates as high as 30% of restaurant professionals left the industry, probably permanently, whether it's fear of COVID, whether it's they found jobs working remotely, or they're just more flexible and allows them to have more of a better relationship and be around more for their kids and things like that. So restaurants have had to, you know, compete by offering higher salaries, right? And you know, Starbucks had announced late last year that they were increasing, that their goal was to increase the average hourly wage to $17 by next summer, which is, you know, obviously well higher than minimum wage in most of the states that it operates, but they have to do it for competitive reasons, right? If they don't start offering higher wages and better benefits, you know, they're going to continue to have trouble staffing the restaurants. You know, for 2022, most of our companies have given a preliminary outlook on what they see labor inflation to be. And it depends on the concept and what states that they're operating in and, you know, things of that nature. But, you know, our companies are talking about between 4 and 10% labor inflation next year. So very significant, probably the highest I've seen in my career. The hourly wage is expected to rise about 9% during the year. So, you know, like I said, it depends on the geography, how much automation can be implemented at the particular chain, but significant pressure on the P&L there for you know, the chains that own and operate their own stores.
Michael, as for labor costs, as a percentage of the pie, we have on one side of the scale, we have this inflation of wages, you know, the marketplace, the demands of the marketplace. But on the other side, we have this quote unquote shortage of workers. So, you know, it seems to me if I'm a Mike Halen's Bar and Grill, you know, I have fewer workers, but I'm paying them more. Where am I netting out in terms of my labor costs? Are my labor costs still more than they were, you know, 2 years ago as a percentage? Are the fewer workers offset the inflationary, the wage inflation?
Yeah, so it depends. It depends. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, labor has become a larger percentage of the operating costs of a restaurant over the last, you know, handful of years. And during that time, for the first time ever, labor became more expensive than food costs. Right. So labor now makes up a larger percentage of the operating expenses than even food does, despite all the commodity inflation that we're seeing.
And, you know, it's, you and I have talked on this podcast before about kind of the differences of young companies, upstart companies that are kind of starting with a clean slate and can build based on the environment that they're in. And then the challenge for legacy brands that have a certain structure and operating process in place. And all of a sudden they've got to adjust to these new circumstances. You know, what are the big legacy brands, the Darden's and the Bloomin's and the Brinker's of the world? Cheesecake, whatever it is, you know, are they just looking long term? Are they just deciding to figure out a way to run a restaurant with fewer employees? Are they figuring out a way to offer fewer menu items? How are they operationally adjusting?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say the first thing that we have seen for most of the chains, excluding Cheesecake, but it is reduction in the size of the menu and focusing a little bit more on items that travel well, since delivery has now become a bigger part of their business. Cheesecake is the exception because, you know, they firmly believe that they have such a loyal customer base because of the wide variety that they offer. But everyone else has definitely reduced the size of the menu and the number of items on their menus. And I don't think they're in any rush to bring them back, right? And increasing the stress on the kitchen when there's the risk of being short staffed on any given night. That's the first thing. The second thing we're seeing pretty significantly is a reduction in hours. This is definitely not what they want to do, but more so what they're forced to do. You know, sales are suffering in the early morning and late night hours because these restaurants are having a particularly tough time getting employees to work those hours. So Domino's and Jack in the Box were two companies that in this past quarter that were mentioned that they were particularly hurt at late night just because of an inability to staff the stores. One more thing, I'd say automation, right? Automation continues to be a priority for these large chains that we cover. And it's something that puts the independents at a disadvantage, right? But, you know, these companies are automating wherever they can. Server handhelds are becoming more ubiquitous, right? Brinker rolled them out nationally. You know, it allows their best servers to cover 5 tables instead of 3. So it reduces some labor on the floor. You also keep your best servers, right? So then your customers tend to have a better experience, which helps. You know, voice ordering is another thing that we're seeing more and more. McDonald's, Domino's, even a smaller chains, more regional chains like Checkers and Rally's is investing in voice ordering at their drive-thrus. And then even back of the house, we're seeing more investments in kitchen display technologies. Chains are making efforts to, you know, upgrade their kitchen equipment so they can, you know, the automated cooking of cheeseburgers at McDonald's is, you know, they can do 4 at a time instead of 2. And they're working to reduce the steps, the number of steps that employees have to make in the kitchen and a bunch of interesting things to try to reduce the number of labor hours required in the restaurants.
Super interesting. You laughed about cheesecake, and you know, I consider myself one of the loyal cheesecake denizens. In fact, there are two things on earth that make me sure that there is a higher power. One is I've been to the Vatican, and the second is the cheesecake celebration cheesecake that is the presence of God on earth. So Michael, tell me, you know, 800-pound gorilla in the room, and we talk about it, you know, all the time, you know, year after year after year, you know, what. There are very few tools in the toolbox for operators. You just talked about a couple of them, but one is, you know, do you take price increases? Do you raise the price? Is there room? Is there elasticity in the marketplace to absorb those price increases? What is your opinion on that one way or the other?
Yeah. And so, you know, with that labor inflation that we're seeing, with the commodity inflation that we're seeing, I think our companies are talking between 5% and 10% next year, depending on the menu, right? Steakhouses have been hit the hardest because beef and seafood prices are up big. But yeah, chains are increasing prices. That's the number one response across the board. Everybody's increasing prices. You know, easily we're going to see another mid-single digit increase from the companies that we cover, probably more if inflation becomes a little more stubborn than maybe some accept. You know, a lot of the companies that we cover are basically keeping their options open, right? They're saying, we're looking at mid-single digits, but if we need to raise again, we will, right? And so to me, higher prices are going to hurt traffic, you know, especially at full service. I mean, full service has already been hurt by falling customer service scores, you know, because of the staffing issues, you know, and we've been, you know, worried about the prospects for full service due to their margin issues. And, you know, if you start losing transactions and at the same time that your margins are getting squeezed, it's a tough spot to be in. You know, we think quick service restaurants are in a much better spot. You know, they have lower price points. They have a lot more value options. Typically what we will see in, you know, recessions, not necessarily calling one right now, but is that there's some trade down where people that typically visit full service restaurants, you know, might make one of those visits. You know, if they go to Chili's once a week, that visit may turn into a visit to McDonald's, right? So there's some trade down. You know, the way to kind of look at those quick service names is, you know, some people are going to fall out of the bucket. Some people are going to fall into the bucket. So overall, their sales declines would be in a very difficult environment. Their sales declines or their sales deceleration will be less so than we'd see at full service. I guess just quickly about a recession, you know, from where I sit, you know, looking at the markets, it's been a tough January. And the old saying is, you know, as January goes, so does the year. I think there's a lot of concern right now about the Fed raising interest rates 3 or 4 times this year in the face of a slowing economy. And so obviously, that would be bad news for restaurants because it's such a discretionary type of visit. And it's usually, you know, when customers tend to cut back on spending, it's one of the first things that go.
So Michael, let's step out outside of the four walls a little bit further. Talk about the industry in general. And, you know, is with all these headwinds, with what's going on in the labor market, what's going on in supply chain, food prices, you know, price increases, is the industry still attractive to investors? You know, we talked before the pandemic, there was so much private equity money going into the industry. We had a lot of money out there on the market looking for places to go. We had a lot of investment in the industry. Is the industry still an attractive investment for A, private equity, or B, pension funds or whatever it may be, stock funds that are purchasing restaurant stock, or C, you know, Mike Halen's got some change in his pocket. Does he buy land or does he buy a Taco Bell franchise? You know what I mean? What's the environment around the attractiveness of the industry right now and going forward for investment?
Yeah, it's a great question. And money's cheap, right? So I don't think PE, you know, in their quest to find the next Chipotle or Shake Shack, I don't think that's going to end. You know, we've seen over the last few years, PE really invests heavily in some of these emerging brands, and we don't necessarily expect that to stop. But as interest rates rise, right, that's going to impact the cost of investment, right? That's going to impact valuation multiples, right? So you could see some contraction in valuation multiples for some of these franchises, right? I mean, they've been selling franchises at multiples we've never seen before, right? So if interest rates rise, we could see kind of multiples contract a little bit here. You know, I think overall what we've seen over the last month is some froth coming out of the market. I mean, you know, the IPOs I think are a sign of this. A lot of these IPOs, there was five that debuted in the second half of last year, and their valuation multiples have contracted pretty significantly. These stocks are trading well off their highs. I mean, Sweetgreen, Portillo's, Dutch Bros, they've all been cut in half basically from their peaks late last year. You know, you've seen a lot of froth coming off of the full service restaurants. They peaked probably mid-year last year, and they've been on this steady decline lower. They're not necessarily trading at very high multiples anymore, but there's some concern about estimates still being too high, maybe for 2022 and 2023 over there. And then, you know, quick service, I think what everybody's looking at them as pretty recession resistant, you know, for the reasons I had mentioned earlier. That's the one segment of the market that still remains pretty frothy, right? Because they did so well during the pandemic. I think there's some recency bias that, you know, some people think they can maybe just sail right through a recession. I think, I don't know about that, right? I don't think we've seen that in the past. I've seen, you know, in the Great Recession, McDonald's did really well because they had the sharpest price points. Their scale allows them to do that. But their competitors didn't necessarily sail through the recession. You look at a company like Domino's, their same-store sales dropped 10% in 2008 or 2009. So I don't think it's necessarily going to be a smooth sailing for QSR as maybe some think it could be.
Interesting. Yeah, you talked about, I like that, not recession resistant. I was going to say, you beat me too. I was going to say recession proof, but I guess nothing's really recession proof, but recession resistant. You talk about trading down. And obviously, the more you trade down, the more the QSR segment's there with open arms, ready for that pass.
They'll feel some trade down too. You know, if the economy does slow, they'll feel some trade down on their menus. So what they've been able to experience over the last 2 years is people frequenting full service less and going to quick service more. But then when they go to quick service, they've been buying the premium items. They've been buying the $7-$8 burger as opposed to something off the value meal. Right. So if the economy slows, then you're going to start seeing people trade down on the menu to cheaper items that have, you know, tighter margins and impacting sales basically that way through lower average checks.
Gotcha. So Michael, let me pivot to one last kind of bucket, and, you know, we don't spend a lot of time on it, but we talked about stock prices. We talked about, you know, the attractiveness for investment. We have one prominent brand in the industry right now kind of going through a not insignificant issue with labor organizing. And we're talking, of course, about Starbucks. Is there nervousness? I know you talk to the financial side of the industry, and you're talking to CFOs and financial people and other journalists and blah, blah, blah. Is there a widespread concern at any significant level about what's happening to Starbucks? and the threat either to their model, their cost structure, or potentially other brands? What's been the vibe out there with regard to Starbucks in your space?
Yeah. So listen, and what we've wrote and what we've spoken to clients about is that, you know, these things take time to work through the system, right? So it is potentially a threat to their margin structure, but it's not going to be a major impact in 2022 or 2023. And speaking to, you know, you hear from management and they continue to downplay it, of course. You know, investors tend to downplay it, but they don't want to show you their cards either, right? They don't necessarily want you want to tell everyone what they're doing. So by reading the tea leaves in terms of the stock price and the action that we've seen since those stores in Buffalo unionized, and some announcements have come out in the last few weeks about more stores having unionization votes, is the stock's been selling off pretty significantly. And part of that has been a little bit of de-risking in the broader market, you know, for the reasons that we spoke about. People are afraid that the Fed could raise rates too aggressively and into a slowing economy and cause a recession. And so investors are taking chips off the table in some of these riskier stocks, including consumer discretionary and restaurants. But Starbucks has underperformed pretty significantly over the last few weeks since those announcements are made. So me sitting here trying to read the tea leaves, I'd say there is definitely some investor concern about the impact of unionization at Starbucks.
Yeah, and it stands to reason. I mean, obviously there are tons, as you laid out succinctly, tons of criterion that go into such a thing as, you know, stock price and perceived growth and blah blah blah. But obviously something like this has to be in that mix and take its toll. You know, I'm struck by Amazon. You know, the delivery economy is just off the charts, and Amazon's stock price in the last 6 months, while they've been going through their notable union stuff in Alabama and New York and so forth, their stock price has nosedived pretty well. Again, a lot of factors play into that, overall market, blah, blah, blah. But you got to believe that's taken, you know, some bite out of that apple. You know, if I were an investment club sitting around a kitchen table in Des Moines, I probably wouldn't want to invest in a company that's got that kind of brand and potential operational risk. To me, there are other places you could park your money. Complicated space, but I appreciate getting your thoughts on that. So, Michael, I mean, I'm getting a sense in conclusion here that it is going to be a rocky 2022, some headwinds for companies to navigate, some rough seas. You concur?
Yeah, so far it looks that way. And as of now, sales are still pretty good, right? I mean, you look at a two-year casual dining, it's, you know, casual dining and QSR, they decelerated in December a little bit, but it's still 2 year same store sales are pretty good. CDRs was still increased 4.6% in December over December 2019. QSR down to 9.3%. So the sky's not falling. I don't want to paint the picture that it's going to be a terrible year. But when you look at the stock market, and the stock market tends to be a leading indicator, and like I said, there's some fears about what the Fed is going to do. I think that's really what's causing the pause. I mean, in general, I would say quick service is still in a pretty good spot. I don't think there's too much risk in terms of their sales cratering like this year, right? I expect QSR to have another strong year. They took some market share during the pandemic from full service, and I don't expect them to give much back. They haven't given much back in 2021. They gave back a lot less than anybody thought. So I think QSR is still in a good spot, right? I think casual dining, look, they're going to be helped by the fact that, you know, 10% or so of independents went out of business. And that number could increase because of the margin issues and some of the things that we spoke about. So casual dining is, you know, in a tougher spot, but I don't think the sky's falling there either. And it's interesting, right? It's like casual dining has a much tougher road ahead, but their stocks are a lot cheaper. And then on the opposite side, quick service is in a much better competitive position, but their stocks are valued and reflected in that. Their stocks reflect that in the valuations that they're getting. So it's kind of interesting, right? From where I sit, you know, I don't necessarily think the sales are going to implode here in the first half, but I think investors are becoming more attuned to the fact that, you know, Fed raising rates could have a meaningful impact on the share prices of restaurants and a whole lot of other industries. Tech's another one that's you know, to your point with Amazon, has had a rough start to 2022.
Well, Michael, I appreciate you helping us sort all that out. As my friends over the pond in England say, get sorted. I appreciate that. Appreciate the fact that you come on fairly regularly and help us kind of, you know, get smart on these numbers. I always feel dumb after talking to you. And then I remember you're a Georgetown guy, you know, smart all around guy. Work for a great firm, Bloomberg, best there is, best firm in terms of this intelligence, Bloomberg Intelligence, and you're their top guy. Really appreciate your analysis, your insight, and your willingness to share it with our audience. Much appreciated, my friend.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It's always fun.
All right. Take care and hope you can get out of your house today for a good working lunch, my friend. Well, Franklin, always good to have Michael's insight. We're very lucky that he comes onto the pod every couple of months and contributes the financial intellect for our audience. I thought, you know, one thing he said that was interesting to me was that, you know, in spite of all those headwinds, in spite of all that's going on out there, yes, the bottom line is the industry is still fairly attractive for investment because of low interest rates. Money's cheap and there aren't a whole lot of places to put it. And so it's still a good place to park your money and get some borrowing money at 1 or 2 or 3%, and you're collecting 5, 6, 7%, you're making money. So you think that all holds water?
I'm going to trust the guy from Bloomberg on that, Joe. I'm going to go with his instincts. So yes.
Yeah, it does sound right. I hadn't really thought of it that way. So illuminating, but it's good to know that we can tap Michael's expertise at any time. So Michael, again, we appreciate you taking time with us. Franklin, one of the things you and I have noted, and we've talked about it briefly on this podcast, is not only the explosion of union organizing activity at media publications, and going on at the New York Times, going on at all these big publications. But in addition to that, it's the investment by a lot of these news entities that have been cutting and slashing newsrooms for a decade or more and actually putting investment into the labor space, hiring reporters to report on Amazon and Starbucks and the NLRB and Fight for 15 and all this stuff. They're actually making investments in that space. Do you think that has long-term implications for how the general public or maybe even our employee base kind of views the business, the employer-employee relationship?
Well, Joe, is it the tail that wags the dog there? Or, you know, is it the staffing up of the newsrooms that is driving interest, or is the interest that is driving the staffing up of the newsrooms? Question for you to ponder, my friend.
That's very insightful and profound. For early morning for you, you must have had a lot of coffee this morning.
I do think there's increased interest in this space. I think we see it in Starbucks and others. I think there's a generational change here kind of occurring. If you look at all the polling, there's just different mindsets with kind of the younger generation and these issues and more of an interest in it. And if it gets clicks, I tell you what, these newsrooms have increasingly got sophisticated, moving away from the old daily model to the online model and what generates interest. And I just think there's more interest in that space all around. And I think, to your point, one does reinforce the other.
I like the tail wagging the dog wagging the tail analogy. Yeah, it used to be kind of a, I don't want to say inside the beltway thing. Obviously, you know, a lot of the bigger publications had, you know, labor reporters and economists, you know, New York Times with, you know, Paul Krugman or Washington Post, Steve Greenhouse, and the New York Times, Steve Greenhouse. But it seems like it's really growing with all these online publications. Heck, even in our own industry, we had last week Peter Romeo from Restaurant Business. He's becoming a union expert in the journalism field. He can hang with the Ben Penns of the world and the Greenhouses. So it's just interesting what's going on out there. I think for corporate communications professionals and external affairs professionals, they need to know, they have awareness that this conversation, this murmur, this background noise is going to be escalating and persistent. It's not going to me, it's going to be less fleeting with a Starbucks victory here or an Amazon defeat there. It's going to be this consistent drumbeat in the broader media that I think people need to, understand. I keep going back to, I hate it that I have to keep going back to your word atmospherics, but it's going to continue to be an audible backdrop, I think, going forward, at least for the foreseeable future. So, that shapes legislative agendas, that shapes messaging, that shapes outreach, it shapes all kinds of things.
I'm going to struggle through this, but hang with me. One of the things that we've seen is private equity has come in and bought up a lot of newspapers and trimmed them down. And this has happened over the past 10 or 15 years where they slash these newsrooms. The way news coverage has changed. And so we just generally speaking have a lot less of the city hall beat and the county commission beat and those hyper local kind of stories. And I think that's a terrible detriment, by the way, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole, that tangent. What you get more of, I think, is these niche reporters that report on these more macro themes that catch interest outside of linking different metro areas together, right? And this goes hand in hand with kind of the nationalization of our politics, right? So I think there's a marketplace driven by social media, driven by some other things, driven by our appetite for this and this push into this, deep partisan rift, for there to be more coverage that feeds that. And so more kind of labor reporters that aren't necessarily reporting about the unions in this city hall or that county commission, but are linking, the labor movement's efforts across markets and writing kind of national stories. I just think there's a greater appetite for that type of reporting, whether it's labor reporting or political reporting or, environmental reporting or whatever. And so I do see that there's kind of a bigger marketplace for that maybe than there had been in the past. And we've seen a shift of resources in newsrooms and new types of journalism too, by the way, new types of outlets emerging that kind of fill that need in the marketplace. So I do think there's more of that. I think a 24-year-old in Boston that's, a Sandinista is probably as engaged and informed in kind of these types of national issues as maybe they ever have been. But like, they may be completely out of hyper local conversations, outside of the issue set they're interested in, but they're super probably educated in climate change or, whatever else. And it's through those online networks and those online stories are fed. So there you go. That's a deep thought by Jack Handy for you, Joe.
I think you're spot on. I think the interesting thing is, as you were saying that, it's like, you were right. You're totally right. I kind of went initially down this union road, but it's really about this workplace. It's almost like worker advocacy in a sense that, since the pandemic, we got millions, tens of millions of workers that have been going through their career and never been involved in any kind of workforce issue, right? And all of a sudden you got groups of people that were now working remotely are essential workers, are now on the front lines, and what's their vaccination policy and childcare issues and all this pandemic has just blown up this whole pool of issues that have not affected large classes of the workforce before. And so now there's this, I'm a worker now in this space. These issues affect me, and so the journalism community, your point, is now in this space and writing from the perspective of the worker and the employee. It's just something that employers, there's no right or wrong. There's just something employers should really understand the dynamic that's underway out there. And you were right to put it in the proper context. It's something we'll keep track on, as we always do. It's time for the legislative scorecard. We go around the country and update you on the latest legislative and regulatory developments. And as always, we start with COVID-19 related stuff. Franklin, not much in the legislative governmental space this week, but a lot in the private sector space. Two nationally known brands, Carhartt and Starbucks, kind of taking opposite approaches. What's going on?
Yeah, they're reacting to the U.S. Supreme Court knocking down the vaccine mandate. Carhartt, and obviously we're going to see more announcement or more news. I don't know that a lot of companies will make big announcements, but a lot of news of companies deciding what to do here. Carhartt has decided they're going to stick with their vaccine mandate. They immediately kind of got pummeled and attacked, and their historical kind of base. There was a thought, the people attacking them thought that their base of the working man would respond negatively and try to play that up in the attack. So I think ultimately Carhartt's going to be fine, but they did get attacked for making this decision. There's no doubt about that. Starbucks, on the other hand, which we reported was one of the first major restaurant brands to kind of announce publicly or have a big public story around what their vaccine policy was. And they were going to require it, and they were going to have employees pay for the test, which is a little bit apart from what we've been hearing that most brands were going to do. They have now pulled back on that. It's an interesting series of decisions out of Starbucks to just have 2 weeks ago, when I think most people had come to the point where they thought there was a good chance the Supreme Court may knock it down. While initially a lot of legal experts had thought it was going to stand up, it had become apparent that it may not be on the firm footing that folks had once thought. To then announce you're going to do it and then essentially 2 weeks later roll it back, I'm not sure what the whole calculus was here, but I can tell you that Starbucks and others in the restaurant industry that are doing everything they can to get to keep the doors open and get employees through the door and keep them on, anything that may disincentivize one employee from not working is hard to embrace at this point. I mean, some of these restaurants, it's the difference between one or two employees, whether or not the restaurant's going to be able to stay open or they're going to have to close for the day. So I can certainly understand that pressure. We've talked about that pressure before, but the announcement and then the pullback is a little weird to me.
Yeah. And I kind of feel for our friends at Starbucks a bit, because the corporate decision-making process is difficult enough. And now they have this shroud, this sort of Damocles hanging over them with what's going on in their workforce with the unionization efforts. Yes, exactly. And so they don't have wartime battle experience doing that day after day, month after month, year after year, having that other kind of entity in that 800-pound gorilla in the room of every decision-making process. You know, and when I was at Walmart, you know, we did what was best for the business. We did what was best for the employees, you know, but we always had to acknowledge that 800-pound gorilla of the UFCW and the SEIU in the room. And so we were used to making decisions. They still are with that context. I suspect very, very few people at Starbucks HQ have that kind of battle experience with this process. And so I think that you're going to see a lot of back and forth. They kind of get their sea legs in this space. So never a dull moment. Franklin, switching to wages. Opposite ends of the country, Hawaii and Virginia active in that space this week.
Yeah, Hawaii legislative leaders are announcing they're going to go up to an $18 an hour mandate, which by my last count would be the highest in the country, right? I mean, other than certainly statewide, I think there's some jurisdictions that have gone up to around that. But the Hawaii legislative process is a little hinky, and it took Hawaii like 15 years to pass a $15 an hour. So there was a minimum wage bill, it seemed like, in the 1 yard line for 8 years in Hawaii. That's obviously hyperbole. It was like 3 or 4 years, though. It was a long time.
We've been talking about it years. And you remember, Hawaii is one of those states that has a, you know, it essentially doesn't have a tip credit, but it does. If you make, forgive me if I'm wrong, but if you make, you know, like $7 over the minimum wage in additional tips, then the employer can take a small, very small, like less than a dollar tip credit against that. So you're talking, you know, a tipped wage of, you know, server wage of $18, and they have to make up to $25 an hour essentially for the employer to take any tip credit. So it's a big number, and that's why we're reporting on it.
Yeah, no doubt. So one to watch there. Flipping back to the other side of the company, a Senate committee rejected legislation to repeal the new minimum wage law that passed last year. And that would have essentially frozen the wage at $11 an hour. Remember, we've had a change in leadership in Virginia. So, you know, we're going to have this tug of war over some of this stuff. So the current law sets a schedule of minimum wage increases. It will see the wage increase each year until $15 an hour by 2025, tied to inflation thereafter. I think that's going to be the standard in Virginia for the foreseeable future, would be my guess.
Yeah. Switching to labor policy, Marty Walsh having an address to the U.S. Conference of Mayors today as we speak, and a little bit of activity, not unimportant, at the NLRB. What's going on, Franklin?
Yes, sir. Our good friend from Miami, Mayor Suarez, and the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and through the, it looks like it's a packed crowd there, which I think was a little unexpected with Omicron, but everybody's happy to get their junkets back under their belts. So the labor secretary trotted over to roll out a workforce development initiative to improve quote unquote job quality, contending that the great resignation was not about employees necessarily resigning from work or leaving work, but, you know, leaving their job because it was not fulfilling enough. So Marty Walsh is going to fix that. That's what he had to say, Joe.
Well, you know, it's details later. So we'll see, you know, what's in there, if anything, you know, maybe more lip service than anything else. But it certainly seems like it's a roundabout, you know, almost passive aggressive way at elbowing entry level jobs, you know, and saying it isn't a labor shortage. It's a shortage of people that want to work for you. And we're going to help them have better jobs. You know, it's like, so who knows? We'll see what happens. But
You see this messaging out of the unions, Restaurant Opportunity Center. There's no labor shortage. There's a wage shortage. Da 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 da.
Yeah. Right. So. And you know, Marty Walsh also, we were all assuming he was hot and heavy going to run for governor of Massachusetts. Seems like he's pumping the brakes a little bit because the Attorney General Marty Healy seems poised to get into that race, and he doesn't. You know, conventional wisdom is she would crush him in a primary. So, well, we may have Marty Walsh around a lot longer than we thought, Franklin. Talk to me about the NLRB. What did they do this week?
They're looking at mandatory arbitration agreements and whether or not they violate labor law. And so they're accepting briefs and whether they want to propose a new rule. These mandatory arbitration agreements have been under attack, and just like kind of the confidentiality agreements in sexual harassment, right? Just like the franchise agreements is anti-competitive. You know, it's one of these mechanisms that's been under attack from a couple different agencies and probably will continue to be. So I expect the NLRB will promulgate some rules in this space.
Speaking of NLRB and our friends at Starbucks, the band continues to play on. The number keeps going up, Franklin. Well, aren't we about 25 cities or 25 units now that are entertaining the thought of union representation?
Yeah, it's happening like labor organizers in their fever dreams hope it will happen. It's organically spreading from restaurant to restaurant. It is obviously
for free. The unions aren't even paying money to do it. It's free. It's happening for free. I think people are losing track of how easy this is happening.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there are organizers there that are assisting and da, 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 da. But like there's an organic element to this. And so here's the other thing that's somewhat disturbing is of those, let's call them 25-ish restaurants, you're starting to see expansion in existing markets, right? So new stores this week in Boston, in the Phoenix area. In Baltimore, we could kind of lump that in with DC, is Metro DC, sort of, kind of not really. But you're seeing also an expansion into new markets too. So Memphis is now on the board. I think Chattanooga was on the board earlier. Richmond is now on the board. So you're seeing growth, organic kind of expansion within the existing markets where they've been organizing and jumping to new markets. Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be a weekly Starbucks watch thing here for the next, I don't know, decade. I mean, foreseeable future. It's happening like it's drawn up in the textbooks. It's supposed to happen. So it's going to be interesting to watch how this all plays out.
And just for a point of clarification, hate to be a homer, but boy, no one in Baltimore would stand idly by and let you say they're just kind of a part of D.C. That's just fighting words in that part of one of the best old rivalries in football is the Baltimore Colts and the Redskins. I mean, that Baltimore does not like to be lumped with DC. So just be careful what you say.
I'm aware. And as it was coming out, I was, you know, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah. DC yeah. doesn't acknowledge Baltimore, and Baltimore has,
and vice versa. It's,
you know, Baltimore has this inferiority complex that's, you know, probably well-deserved, but anyway, Franklin, lastly, sustainability, our new favorite topic, EPR, extended product responsibility, Senate producer responsibility, excuse me. New Hampshire this week had an entire slate of legislative proposals across numerous committee hearings about, you know, their master plan on waste management and landfills, and, you know, where they're running out of space, and they're taking a very holistic approach to this whole thing. And our new favorite subject, EPR, is a part of that. What's going on in New Hampshire?
they've got Senate committees across both bodies, the upper and lower chamber, that are looking at this, as you said. And I will say the New Hampshire, like Maryland, is probably a good place to go play and try to get some model legislation. I mean, even, you know, it's divided government, and New Hampshire historically, even when it had one party control one way or the other, has always taken a very deliberate approach to issues. I mean, they have kind of a track record of being very deliberative and looking at balanced legislation. So I would really be getting involved and engaged in New Hampshire and Maryland conversations ASAP, your folks within your brand, within your company that are focused on this space.
And I think, you know, and reading through, you know, as much as I've read on it this week, you know, it's, I think the employer community, and in our case, the restaurant industry, needs to understand that nobody is attacking. Nobody's saying, hey, man, they're McDonald's wrappers on the curb. They're saying, hey, we've got a landfill issue. We're running. We got no place. We're the granite state because we can't dig down. We're like Florida. We can't do this anymore. We've got to figure this out. And a piece of this is not only managing what we have and what's coming, but a piece is what we're creating and how we're sourcing it. And so there's no boogeyman. There's nobody getting attacked. But to your point, it's a huge opportunity for us to get in and level set with elected officials about how, you know, our industry can best participate without becoming that boogeyman, be part of the solution without becoming the problem. And it's going to take some forward thinking and to get out of our kind of rut of hell no.
Yeah. And I think I said New Hampshire's divided government, and I'm turning that over in my head. Republicans have actually seized control. They have a trifecta. It's a small majorities by New Hampshire standards. I think it's 3 or 4 seats in the upper chamber.
But I think your broader point is still, I mean, their entire congressional delegation, I think, is Democratic. So it's a centrist state. No matter who's
100%, and it flips back and forth, and it wouldn't be surprising if it flips. Democrats had total control of the legislature before, and then Republicans unexpectedly. The bottom line, though, is it's still a perfect environment to go get a model policy. And I would say even more so with, you know, Republicans in control with slim majorities, because they're going to have to probably get some Democratic support. And so you're going to end up with what is going to be balanced policy. So go to New Hampshire, get involved, get engaged. Look at Maryland. Those are great places to be playing and having these conversations.
Well said. And that's a good note to end our scorecard this week. And we'll have more for you next week. Well, my friend, another week, another pod. But as we leave you this week, my old alma mater and our current business partner, Walmart, making some news in the food delivery space. Frank, what's going on at the Mart?
Yeah, they were running ads in Politico that they're staffing up. They're going to have associates, essentially a full-time delivery force, which, you know, we were talking before. I mean, you can't even remember a day. It was only 3 or 4 years ago that Amazon was still relying on the U.S. Postal Service and FedEx and UPS and didn't have their own delivery force. And then they've built it up. And then during the pandemic, it hit hyperdrive as they stole all our employees. Yeah. So Walmart is clearly gearing up in that space. And I've gotten Walmart groceries delivered before. It usually is like a 6-8 hour lag. They've moved to the same day, the more immediate grocery delivery, kind of the Amazon Prime model or the model of the delivery platforms with the grocers. So yeah, we can order our Walmart bakery or a hot meal to go from Walmart or Amazon, potentially Whole Foods, or we can go get it from one of our restaurants, Joe. That's where the marketplace is going. It's changing and changing quickly.
That true words have never been spoken, my friend. It is always changing quickly. So on that happy note, we will leave you for this week. We'll be back with you next week. And until then, stay safe, stay informed, and we'll talk to you then.